From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in my email inbox. Does that sound exciting to you? Stay with me here for a second. I've got roughly 1,400 emails in my inbox right now, which is just about average for me at any one time. But one of them made me actually say, wow. Now, when's the last time you heard someone say anything optimistic about climate change or climate action? The scientific realities have been coming at us with a kind of frightening rhythm, and most governments around the world are just kind of dithering around the edges with small steps. So that's, by the way, that's according to scientists. That's not my analysis. So here's the email that moved me. It came from Al Hibner, a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby. It was in regards to a new piece of legislation that the U.S. House will consider called the Energy Innovations and Carbon Dividend Act of 2018. Al wrote to me, quote, "The possibilities represented by this bill are transformational. They give all of us renewed hope in these hyper-partisan times. We are all thankful to be a part of this history in the making," end quote. My goodness, Al, are you trying to give someone a stroke here? Optimism is not entirely banned yet, but it is strongly frowned upon these days. So why might this bill be a difference maker? What exactly does it do? And can we really expect Congress to get serious about it? Let's see if the optimism can be sustained after 51 minutes with our guests in studio. Al Hibner is a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby and Project Drawdown, and it's nice to see you back here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us back.
Also with us is Rob Levine, a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Rob, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Evan.
And Abby McHugh Griffa is the Executive Director of Rochester People's Climate Coalition. And an optimist? Are you an optimist, too, on this?
I have my days.
I've never known that from you. All right, so let's get serious for a second here because, I'm having a little fun with this because it's nice to feel a sense of optimism. But, Al, is there any hyperbole in the email or you really feel like this piece of legislation can do what you want it to do?
Yes, I do. I absolutely do. It's effective. It starts by attacking the IPCC goals for within 12 years by reducing 40% of our carbon emissions within 12 years by 2030. It's good for people. It improves health and safety of our people by reducing pollution. It's good for the economy. It's going to generate 2.1 million jobs in 10 years. It's revenue neutral. This is really critical. It does not grow the size of government. All the net revenues from this bill are returned to Americans equally. And most importantly, it's bipartisan. That provides hope for its passage.
How many members of Congress do you have in line? Like 100 or 200 signed on so far? Or is it more like 6?
Well, this bill was introduced...
Somewhere between the two.
It's introduced in the lame duck, so it's going to be reintroduced in the next seated Congress. So we have three sponsoring members that are Democrats and three that are Republicans to start. We expect that to grow in the re-release of the bill in the coming session.
All right. So, listeners, we are going to get a little wonky with the bill this hour. That's why they're here. And that's important. I mean, I think we ought to know if we're going to see real progress toward reduction of emissions and an impact here on climate action, what it looks like, what it feels like to us. And we'll press Al, Rob, Abby on the notion of revenue neutral. We'll talk about job creation. These are all things that have to be considered as part of this. Abby, since you've started doing work in this field, there's a lot of different parts to it. It's galvanizing public opinion. It's educating the public. It's making sure people care. It's having people understand climate impacts in their lives now as opposed to some sort of far-off abstract that they can sort of set aside. Does this one feel different to you? Does this bill feel different to you?
Well, this particular piece of the legislation is something I've been working on since I got involved. It's been, for me, a five-year process to getting to this point. And so, you know, you asked me earlier if I... You know, I'm a hopeful person on this issue. And my goodness, the day that I got that text message saying that this bill had been introduced was, wow. I mean, I cannot put it into words the sense of relief and optimism that I experienced. And in terms of your list of, you know, basically what I spend my time doing through this work, the thing you really missed was educating people about solutions.
Okay.
You know, it is important to know what the impacts are. It is important to know, what the nitty-gritty of the legislation is. But it's really important as for individuals to know how they can participate in that process and what they can do. Because I think that's one of the main barriers to moving forward, is people feeling this problem is too huge. What could they possibly do as a single person? And in fact, there's tons. that we all can be doing. So really getting the word out about that. We can talk about that all you want.
Well, and, you know, before the hour began, you know, we all talked about the different panelists and what they want to focus on. So let me follow up in one way with you that's not wonky.
Okay.
That is aimed directly at something that matters deeply to you, which is the impact on our kids.
Mm-hmm.
I recently had a conversation with a friend who was saying, is it child abuse to have children in 2018, 2019? I mean, it's a flippant question, but it's also, it's at least in the realm of something people should think about, given the possible direction of our planet. And I think the first time you ever were on this program, I think you were moved to emotion thinking about kids, the future, et cetera. You know, your kids are a little bit older now. So, you know, I'm sure you talk with them about this.
All the time.
Do you feel more fear for them? Do you feel optimism? Because as a parent of a six-year-old, I feel both. But there are times where I feel like his generation, they're gonna do this. They're going to do this. They're probably going to resent previous generations to some degree. But I think they're going to do this. I wonder how you feel about this.
Well, yeah, I am trying as a parent to actively give my children the skills that they will need and the knowledge they will need to be part of the solution and to move forward in a totally non-scary way. You know, I mean, my kids are 3 and 5, just about to turn 3 and 5, and they're too young for really sort of the weight of, you know, the doom and gloom.
Yeah. Listen, 5-year-old. Let me tell you what's going on.
It's coming later. Don't push it now.
Well, and I mean, I talked to them very frankly about that this is a huge problem. It's a global problem. But again, about what they can do to be part of the solution in a proactive way. I love actually hearing them talk about it because they're so matter of fact and frank about, you know, like... where do we compost? Do we eat meat? Are we driving or walking or riding our bikes? And what, you know, those choices that we make on a daily basis, I want to empower them to know that their choices matter. Now, where I really feel frustrated as a parent is some of the systems we're involved in that don't reinforce those messages. So I love my children's school. I think the place where they go to school is great. But the styrofoam kills me every time I see the amount of waste in styrofoam. It just kind of breaks my heart, and the fact that is so systemic, it's, you know, just so widespread. And you know, I mean, I grew up in that, right, where we just threw stuff away and didn't think twice about it.
Yep.
And so we really need to be thinking hard about kids growing up right now and how we prepare them for this.
But be honest, when school administrators see you coming to the building, do they lock the door?
You know, I haven't made a fuss yet. I haven't. And I've really been wrestling with how much of a pain in the butt to be about this issue in particular.
I'm with you, though, because systemically, it's a lot to change.
Yeah.
And that's part of the big conversation about this bill, which we're about to dive into, is what needs to change, how it happens, what the impacts are. But that's why I wanted to talk to Abby just sort of on these data. But I do feel optimistic because when I talk to kids our kids' age, mostly it's about how you guys are going to do amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, yeah, yeah, we are.
Yep.
We totally are. And I'm sorry, I'm with you there. And I do feel optimistic when I talk to children, less so when I talk to adults. So...
What about us, Evan? I mean, come on.
No, I mean like world leaders.
Well, you know, interestingly, we do a lot of work, Al and I both, with high school and college age kids, empowering them to get involved in our case, climate solutions, but also to show them that they have influence. And ever since the Parkland shooting, high school and college age kids seem to have really stepped up their game and are willing to put in a lot of time.
You mean in activism
like
or work on all issues?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the group we're working with at St. John Fisher College is going to be presenting to President Rooney and some other members of the administration to ask them to support the policy we're about to talk to today. And that's all driven from within the St. John Fisher community and through the student activity. And that's really what gives us hope because, you know, we're at the end of our influence here. Maybe not too far at the end, right? But it's that generation that really is going to make the biggest difference, I think, and they're active.
When we engage them and bring them into lobby meetings with the members of Congress, the members of Congress and their staff, they just sit up and take notice.
Yeah, they control the
room. Absolute. The most powerful voices that we bring to the table.
Well, Let's talk about what the bill is, and first and foremost, where you can learn more. This is going to be a process because Al's right. This is a sort of a lame duck session now, so for it to come up in Congress is more symbolic. It will come up again, and then the question becomes, what does the public say about it? What does Congress feel about it? I don't sit here as a journalist able to sort of advocate in any way, but what I can tell you is there's something refreshing about this moment because for too many years and for far too long, we spent way too much time on, well, is climate change really happening? And what's the science say? Knowing long ago that, of course, climate is changing and, of course, humans are impacting the climate. I always said as journalists, we do much better once we get into the debate about we know it's happening. Policy-wise, this is where we will differ. We have to get around our heads around together, all people, all backgrounds, all ideologies on the climate is changing. We may disagree on what policy should be implemented or what we can do, and that's where we are now. So this is a big piece of policy, and mm-hmm. this would be a very, very significant change. The name of the bill, once again, Al, and I suspect you want people to not only look it up, but probably, you know, let people know that they know about it. What's it called?
It is formally the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act of 2018. It will be re-released in the next Congress as 2019.
And what do our local-ish representatives that we know of say? Incoming, well, now member of Congress Joe Morelli, what does John Katko, Tom Reed, what do we know about what they're saying?
Chris Collins,
he doesn't call me back, but
we're lobbying directly with Senator Schumer's office, and we've engaged that discussion. We presented the bill. We've asked to have it praised or discussed by Senator Schumer, and we also have talked with or will be talking with Representative Morelli very quickly about it. He seems positive about the bill. We haven't really had a complete discussion with him yet.
Okay, and I know that WXXI has been in touch with Congressman Morelli, and on next week you should hear some reporting about his views on climate as we learn more from him and his office about that. Okay, so the question is, what does this bill do? So it's the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act of 2018, soon to be 2019 as they head into the next session. Al, let's start at the top here. The big way that you're going to get 40% reduction in emission in 10 years and how much by 2050?
By 2050, it's estimated to be a 90% reduction.
90%
yes,
reduction.
That is correct.
I mean, that is a big number.
It tracks very close to IPCC recommendations.
Okay. Because, later this hour, we will talk about whether even this is enough. But for a moment, let's just talk about what it does here. So what's big point number one?
Point number one is a carbon fee. It puts a fee on fossil fuels like oil and gas. It starts low at $15 a ton and grows $10 per ton equivalent CO2 emissions
every
year.
Who gets charged the fee?
The fee is charged to the producers of the fossil fuels at as close to the source as possible, the well, the mine, or the port. And it goes into a trust fund to be administered by the federal government.
Okay, so I'm a producer. You're hitting me with, $15 a ton to start? That it grows over time. And okay, so I keep producing. Now I'm paying this fee. It goes to you in the federal government, and you're going to do what with the money?
The federal government is going to return every net dollar of that to the American populace as equal shares. Each adult and each child in America will receive a dividend. It'll come back as a direct deposit to your bank account or as a check.
I'm going to get a check from the federal
government.
Yes, on a yearly basis?
Every month. Monthly. Monthly basis.
Like 98 cents a month?
No.
$19 a month? What do you
expect? A family of four could effectively be looking at, as the program gets going, at $3,000 to $4,000 a year annual dividend amounts. Not chump change.
Okay, so we're talking $300 a month, roughly on average, for
yes,
a family of four.
Right.
That's a massive change.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but now let me challenge you on a couple of things here. You said that this is not going to grow the size of the federal government.
Correct.
You're going to have a number of listeners, and I was going to say conservative, but you're going to have anybody listening saying, do the math for me here. How are you going to create a new fee on the production of these kinds of energy, and you're going to need a federal program to collect it and then administer it, but you're not going to grow the government? How are you going to do that?
That is correct. Basically, we're already aware of the totality of all of the fossil fuels that are produced. We know what they are. We know how many barrels of oil are going through pipelines. So the mechanics, the accounting of actually doing it are quite simple. And having the administrative capability to do that, we're looking at no more than a 2% of that fee collected being for administrative costs to administer the program and deliver the funds going down the road.
Okay, so existing agencies and people are going to do
this?
It's
already being done. Yeah, we're measuring that stuff already. Mm-hmm. So what we're not doing is levying the fee based on the information that we have.
Okay.
It's going to use information from the IRS and information from other federal agencies to create the trust fund. It'll be a separate agency in that sense, but with one purpose, to do away with itself over time.
Okay. Next question. Government does seem to, at most levels, have a bit of a history with saying, all right, this tax is temporary, or we will collect this money, but we will distribute it back to the people. And then government gets their hands on it, and they go, ooh, I know what I could do with this instead.
Yeah, that can't really happen with this bill, because at the end of the month, the trust fund must be empty. So the comparison
the
is
the legislation
often,
requires it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So the comparison is always about Social Security, and supposedly the government robs, you know, Social Security to use the money for other purposes. That's not really true, because Social Security allows for a surplus at the end of every month. And by law, that surplus is then invested in government bonds. And that's how the government can get its hands on the surplus. There's no surplus at the end of every month, then there's nowhere for the government to reach in and divert the funds to other purposes.
The term is 100% pass-through.
Okay. But there's no scenario in which the fee would be levied, but the American populace would not see the dividend.
Only if they change. If the legislation is changed by another Congress in the future.
Okay.
Which, once the fee starts, it becomes very sticky.
Get a check, they're not going to support it.
That is true. That's a bit. That's very true. The American population will probably enjoy getting those checks on a monthly basis. Now, the idea here being that because of the fee, behaviors are about to start changing, right? So if I'm a producer and I'm starting to pay this fee, is it designed to knock me out of business eventually?
No. No,
I mean,
not at all.
I don't necessarily care one way or another if the answer is yes or no. I'm just asking.
Yeah. No, it's not. And okay. I can give you a very cogent, I think very concise example. ExxonMobil is working on carbon capture and sequestration technology to scrub 90% of CO2 out of the emissions from a gas power plant. If they can put that technology in place, which this bill covers, it covers the ability to be refunded for carbon capture and sequestration. If they can do that, then they can benefit. They can sell more of their product to a power plant at lower price. So they compete much better in an innovative way to sell their products.
Okay.
So the companies that innovate and that make this transition will succeed, will thrive.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
Could be. Yeah.
Okay. So let's continue working with how this is designed, because that fee, again, goes up over time.
Yes.
Starts at $15 a ton.
Yes.
I don't know if that's a lot or a little, because I don't know.
It's relatively manageable. There are other plans out there that start as high as $45 per ton in year one.
Okay.
That would be disruptive to a lot of people. The other thing that's...
Would that be too disruptive, you think?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I don't think it's disruptive enough, but I lean in that direction.
Well,
no, but the other important thing is...
This is where the fun is. The policy debate is what we should be having.
The other important thing is this bill allows for a pre-dividend. So even before the dividend is levied, so before you feel it at the pump, people will receive that first dividend check to offset what's expected to come shortly thereafter.
All right. So,
which is an interesting twist to the bill.
I know we're covering this, and I know you just worked through some of the functionality of it, but I'm going to ask it in a slightly different way, because I want to make sure that we're all in agreement on how this is supposed to be carried out. Right now, we're having a debate about tariffs, this notion that, and the market's down 433 points again today. It's been a fascinating week.
Fascinating year, Evan.
Yes. Anybody, how's everyone 401ks? If you're fortunate enough to have a 401k, and I know that's a very privileged statement, but this is a president who loves to talk about 401ks and loves to talk about the market, and the market is now down for the year.
Yeah.
Most of it following talk of tariffs, right? So it's this notion that, well, we'll impose a tariff and it will benefit us, when the reality that we are seeing unfold is the consumers end up paying, and the market, largely the market, whatever this nebulous thing is, knows that. And the White House is not really fooling anybody with that.
Right.
And we have Democrats and Republicans pointing that out right now. The tariffs are just going to be hitting the consumer. The same concern is going to be raised probably that, okay, you can impose this fee at the point of production or closest to the source as you can. And if I'm the producer, fine. I jack up prices, or the right. prices come back to you and you and you. And all that it really does is my bottom line stays the same, but the consumers pay more. So, okay, so you cut them a check every month, but nothing really changes because maybe the check covers the offset, but everybody keeps producing fossil fuels. Everybody keeps consuming them, and money just starts floating around. Push back on that for me.
I will. On an individual basis, I have a case in point. I have an old gas furnace in my basement, in-law apartment. Do I replace it with gas, or do I go to electricity and then involve solar? Do I start to make personal decisions that will actually, I could keep more of my dividend. If I switch to electricity and not gas, the gas price won't go up, and I can make that choice.
All right, so that's relying, though, on individual consumer choices as well.
That's what
it's all part of this. Here.
Right, and businesses will be doing the same thing. They want to compete in the marketplace.
Right.
So all businesses will get just a supercharged market price signal to make innovative changes.
And that's one of the real appeals on a bipartisan level, is that it's a market-based approach.
Yes.
The government's not telling people what choices to make
yes.
or what form of energy we're going to replace oil and gas with. The market gets to do that, really without interference from the government. And so innovation will be rewarded.
And not picking winners in technology.
Right.
Not picking them.
Just go ahead, Abby.
Well, just that, you know, I think that idea of prices going up, we all sort of have this gut reaction to the idea of prices going up. It's a scary idea, right? The issue being that right now fossil fuels are artificially inexpensive. It might not cost you much to fill up your gas tank, but in fact, you're still paying for the social cost of carbon through all the money we spend on natural disaster relief, national security, healthcare. There's so many other ways that we're paying for the true cost of burning fossil fuels that maybe we don't pay directly at the pump.
Right.
So fossil fuel prices right now, they are just too low. And that's why we're so addicted to them, why we can't wean ourselves off. So we are not even pretending for a second that fossil fuel prices aren't going to go up. In fact, that's the whole
point
is that we want fossil fuels to be more expensive to make renewables more competitive. And then again, it is the dividend to American households that make this transition doable, and that also incentivize, you know, you could call it good behavior, but just fiscally sound choices when it comes to making this transition.
And just to add one point, what Abby's making, because I think I understand how certain things come off to different listeners or different ears. When Abby says we want fossil fuels to be more expensive, to my ear, it means two different things. Number one, we functionally want that because then people will consume less of them, and that is the number one goal here. But she's also saying she wants them to be sort of more actually priced and not artificially deflated or artificially low. So right now, the cost of fossil fuels that we see, at least in what we as consumers are paying, and just take the gas pump as one example, is artificially low given the myriad other costs associated with them that we're not always thinking about.
Correct.
So it's the same way as saying, well, I want the cost of cigarettes to be high because I don't want you to smoke. But I also want you to understand that if a pack of cigarettes is cheap and more people smoke, there are myriad other costs,
correct,
healthcare and otherwise, associated with that, that you're not thinking about at the point of purchase. That's kind of what I'm at least hearing.
That's an excellent analogy.
And there's another side of this too, Evan, is that as this process takes place, it's estimated within 6 to 7 years, price of energy is actually going to start to decrease. So rather than continuing paying increasing prices for fossil fuels, you will start paying lower prices because you're being powered with renewable energy sources, which are less expensive.
But I want to talk about what the world's about to look like here, because if this bill passes, it's a lot to ask it to pass. And frankly, there's a couple of things here.
We're patient. And persistent.
I'm with you, because when Rob said earlier, the bill's maybe not even disruptive enough for your own personal taste.
Right.
That is different than maybe saying, I don't know that Congress would pass a $45 a ton right out of the gate fee.
Right.
Maybe that this is designed to be a little bit more palatable to a Congress.
I think it is.
I mean, just pragmatically.
The conservative-led Climate Leadership Council,
yeah,
with Secretaries Baker, Paulson, Schultz, some very conservative economic thinkers, their plan starts at $45 per ton.
Okay.
So it's not an unreasonable thing to think that's the case.
It's not an anodyne bill, but this is much less disruptive. I think that's fair to say.
Yes.
But do you still think that realistically there's enough to get this through a full... You got to get it through a
full...
You got a lot of layers to get this through.
Yeah, I do think there will be.
You think this will pass Congress in 2019?
Don't give me that.
That's a heavy lift.
No, that's a heavy lift. I think in the next 2 years, it's a very difficult thing to do. But the current administration may not pass the last 2 years, and then I think it has a much better possibility.
Because if you read the science, if the science is sort of telling us right now, and this is not meant to be apocalyptic, but if this bill passes in 5 years, then you got to rewrite the whole thing and make it much more aggressive,
right?
Because of what we're doing,
right?
And so, okay, so realistically, the soonest this thing could pass and actually become law would be 2021.
I'm going to say 2019. I am optimistic on that, and you know what the reason is. The reason is because of how many average citizens are speaking up and putting pressure on their elected leaders and saying, no, this is important. And the American public, you know, the numbers on the American public that has now on board with the idea that climate is real and it's bad and it's human caused and we need to do something about it. Those numbers are just going up and up and up and up and up. And politicians do respond to political will. Right. So the more phone calls we can generate, the more letters we can write, the more, you know, we can get this in the media. Thank you, Evan, for having us on your show.
Yes.
Tides turn very quickly when you know, public opinion changes on an issue. And this is
there's a tipping point. We might be there. You know, one more flood, one more fire. What's it going to take to really snap people's attention?
I'm hopeful for 2019, Abby. I'm with you. I'm probably more realistically thinking it's going to take an administration change. Maybe we're looking at 2020, more of a time frame there. But the signals are coming stronger and faster. Yesterday, we found out that our emissions in this country had grown 2.7%, over 1.6 in 2017, over three flat years. Our emissions are going up worldwide. And we just have to stop that. We just actually have to turn that tide.
Yeah. The need for energy is going to continue to increase, so we need to do it in the most appropriate way.
Okay. So what the world looks like when this bill is implemented, and after our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about what this country effectively looks like in 10 years. And if you are like me and you're thinking about, oh, I have to buy a new car soon, when is the year? I'm going to ask our panel. When is the time we actually have to start asking ourselves, if I buy a car that consumes actual gasoline, is that going to be a viable thing by the time I'm still driving this? So are we approaching that time? I actually have to think about that right now. Anybody got any cars they want? That's actually really crass.
Yeah.
So let's get our only break of the hour before I start asking listeners to sell me their cars. And we're going to come back and we're going to talk about what the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act might do for this country, for the world around us, and how things will change. I mean, there, you know, life would change in some substantial and ways that I think that our guests think would make life a lot better here. So we're going to talk about that as well. Our guests include Abby McHugh Griffa, the executive director of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, Rob Levine, a member of CCL, that's the Citizens Climate Lobby, and Al Hibner, a member of Citizens Climate Lobby and Project Drawdown. We're right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Hilda Rosario Escher and Angelica Perez Delgado. Hilda is the outgoing CEO for the Ibero-American Action League, and Angelica is the incoming CEO. We'll talk to them about their plans in Rochester. We'll talk to Hilda about what her post-CEO career will be like, and we're also going to talk about the fact that both women needed services when they were younger and how that will inform their work. That's coming up. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I've got some emails from our listeners, and I'll read them in just a moment. Connections@WXXI.org. If you want to weigh in, we're talking about the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act that our guests are telling us, in their view, could be transformational and the kind of policy that might actually do the kind of work that our country needs to do on climate action within 10 years and certainly by 2050. It would be a massive change. And right now, there is a chance that Congress could take this up and maybe address this as soon as 2019. So that's what we're talking about this hour. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. So this thing passes, and how does our world start to change? Well, one of the things we talked about during our brief break, and Rob Levine, I think we'll just pick it up right here. You made a remark about charging stations, that right now the infrastructure is still, you know, inadequate based on what the need is going to be. But certainly, even in 24 months, we've seen a lot more charging stations around town at various places, different stops on the thruway, people are charging at home. I think EV and the use of electric vehicles, we are seeing what is a pretty rapid change. Where do you think is that's probably a big part of this?
Oh, absolutely. Change. And it's entirely necessary. So if you're looking at transportation, the need for electric buses, the need for charging stations, you know, we talked earlier too about the need for infrastructure repair in this country. Why would we repair old style infrastructure rather than replace it with what we're going to need 50 years from now? And so that, I think, is really one of the keys is we're talking about changing the power grid in some way, shape, or form. And how that's going to look, I don't think any of us really know. But it's going to be towards electricity because we don't have a choice. You know, we really don't have a choice. So the question is, how quickly can we do that?
Yeah.
And as Abby alluded to before, it's all about political will. And so we need to keep people pushing.
Yeah.
You know, you can drive from Buffalo to Albany on the thruway, and you will not see a charging station. On the way back, there's one hidden in one rest stop that doesn't even have a gasoline.
Signage.
Yeah, it doesn't have a sign for gasoline because it's that one rest stop between Utica and wherever. And that has to change. And as it does, people will buy more electric cars. And as there's a need for more electric cars, there will be more charging stations.
Yeah, and that is, Al used a term I had not heard before, though, but range anxiety is a part of this. The people I know who are driving electric vehicles are pretty well aware of where these stations are, especially if they're making out-of-town trips, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. If they cannot make it to their destination without charging and there's no charging stations along the way, it's problematic. You're not going to buy that EV.
If you were to buy a Tesla today and planned a trip across country, they will route you from charging station to charging station.
Yeah, so that need
it becomes a much longer trip when you try to find those.
Absolutely.
But it allows you to get there on 100%, you know, electric fuel.
All right, so that's part of how the world is changing. Abby McHugh Griffa, what do you think the world looks like in 10 and 20 years after this passes that it doesn't look like today?
Well, I think our healthcare costs will be going down. People will be healthier. We don't need to breathe in diesel fuels anymore, our diesel emissions. So there's a lot of positive feedback. On just purely economic terms, when people are getting this dividend check in their, you know, automatically put in their bank account every month, most people, at least about, you know, two-thirds of people, will have some extra at the end of the month. So what will people spend that money on? Maybe they'll be able to go out to dinner more. Maybe they'll, put their kids in dance lessons. Who knows what it is? But people, kind of your average everyday folks, especially those who are making the choice to go for the electric car or to heat their house with a heat pump, they're going to have money left over at the end of the day, which will provide economic stimulus kind of across the board. So there will be both the clean energy jobs in that sector. But then there's also, you know, just people being able to spend money on services and goods. So I think economically, this is a boon kind of across the board. Also, an equalizer in terms of, you know, the people who currently have the smallest carbon footprint are low-income folks. You know, they're not living in huge houses. They're not driving big SUVs. They don't fly, you know, across the world. So those are the folks who, at the end of the month, will, you know, percentage income-wise, have a bigger boost from this policy. So that to me is really exciting, and I think it's also one of the tragically misunderstood aspects of carbon pricing. So I don't know if you guys remember, you know, Washington State has been working to get a carbon tax passed for a while now. 2 years ago, the reason that it didn't pass, it was a ballot initiative. The reason it didn't pass was largely because of opposition from green groups and from the left. And in some circles, you know, there's a lot of misconception about carbon pricing and, you know, the idea of market-based solutions. And some fears around that, you know, that if conservatives are on board, it must be a bad thing. Well, in fact, that's not true. But again, this carbon tax in Washington, D.C. was the first time around was largely defeated because of opposition from green groups. Now, the second time around, they tried to accommodate for that by not having this policy to return the revenue just entirely to households. And then it was defeated because people were like, well, where's the money going to go? How's the government going to spend that money? You know, how do we know? Will it be wasted? So the idea with this policy of returning money to American households, I think really that's where the bipartisanship comes in and the opportunity for working together and actually getting it done.
Let me read some feedback from listeners if we could here. And I'm going to start with Carl. Before I read Carl's email, it calls to mind for me a story that I just was reading this morning that in the capital region of India, in Delhi, people are living 6 to 10 years shorter because of air pollution. Mm-hmm. And Carl's concern is that if we go forward with a bill like this, again, it's the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act of 2018 that Congress could take up as soon as next year in this country. Carl's concern is, what about the rest of us? So he writes, Evan, this is another step to drive manufacturing out of the United States. How can we pay a carbon tax when the rest of the world won't? How do your guests propose to get the rest of the world on board with this? From Carl.
I've got to tell you that basically, how come the United States hasn't caught up with the rest of the world? Much of the rest of the world is already on board with carbon pricing. Carbon, basically, we are the kind of the slacker here. We had one of our members go to COP24 in Poland just 2 days ago and say, we're back. We have a potential for a bill that is really could lead the world. So the bill was discussed at a press conference. We're behind the rest of the world, right. You know, not.
But the bill also contains a border adjustment. So yes. the you mentioned tariffs before. There's an equalizer here so that there are penalties for companies going offshore to create products in carbon intensive ways. And there's a adjustment so that foreign companies who don't have to pay that carbon fee could sell goods cheaper here. So that evens out the playing field for corporations, and it really provides a stimulus for other countries to adopt their own carbon fee so that the playing ground is neutral. And there's really a strong feeling that if U.S. were to do this, the rest of the world would quickly fall in line because we are such a significant player.
And finally, the idea that innovation will spur manufacturing, because it will, but it will be different types of manufacturing for the future in 10, 20, 30 years.
All right, let's get through some more feedback. Phone calls. This is Seneca Falls. This is Charlie. Go ahead, Charlie.
Oh, okay. I rented a Tesla in San Francisco last October. Had it for a weekend. Real nice car, but 250-mile range is what it says it's got. I drove from San Francisco to Yuba City and was not going to get back to San Francisco based on the 250-mile range. Charging stations exist, but they're hard to find, and every charging station has a different flavor. So you go to a Nissan Leaf charging station, you can't plug in your Tesla, at least not easily. I ended up going to the lumberyard, getting enough electrical parts to make something that we could plug the car into the driver's or the dryer socket in my cousin's house. 30-amp circuit, it took 9 hours to recharge the car to go back to San Francisco. If you get to a Tesla supercharger and you're the only car there, you can charge basically an empty battery in about 2 hours. But if there's multiple cars there, you either wait for a plug or you charge at a much slower rate. So, yes, you can go cross-country, but add a 3 to 4 hour stop every 200 miles to do it. It's coming, but it's not there yet.
All right, Charlie, thank you. I mean, I think it's fair criticism because part of the infrastructure change, it's part technology because, mm-hmm. you know, the reps from Tesla, not Elon himself, I haven't talked to him directly, but they tell us the same thing that other innovators will tell you, that we are going to get charging stations that are much more efficient and will charge more quickly. Oh. We will see that.
Yeah.
And that's part of the build-out. But I don't know more about what he's talking about in terms of fitting, you know, sort of fitting one part into another.
Well, I can speak to that having a semi-electric car. Tesla's unique in that the Tesla charging station and system only works for Tesla cars. So if you are a Tesla owner, you have to find a Tesla station. My car, which is a Prius, can be charged virtually every other type of charging station that's out there. I think that's the same with your mm-hmm. with your Leaf.
I just
right?
plug it into a yeah. regular outlet.
And I plug it into my garage every night. And the next morning it's charged for my use. So, and things are coming. My wife has wanted a truck for I can't tell you how long, and now there are pickup trucks that are going to be available within probably a year and a half to 2 years with 200 to 300 mile range, which is pretty good. We have to be somewhat patient for the technology to catch up, but the way to spur that innovation
absolutely
is to make sure that gas is so expensive that everybody wants to innovate
right.
to get away from gasoline.
Yeah, I mean, they really started selling toasters when everyone wanted to eat bread. So there
right?
you go.
It's true.
Everyone on the block bought bread. They're going to make more toasters.
Actually, it was the slicer. It was the slicer of the bread.
So it was a slicer. Yes, I hate manual slicing. A lot of feedback. I want to get through as many emails and phone calls as we can before the end of the hour with our guests who are here from Citizens Climate Lobby, Rochester People's Climate Coalition, talking about the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act that they think can be transformational. Dan writes to us and says, ideally, politicians respond to public opinion, which is why today we have universal health care that covers everyone. He says, I don't want to poo-poo optimism, and this bill sounds like a good step, but realistically, politicians don't respond to public opinion much, if at all. I would say observationally before our guests respond, Dan, politicians respond, first of all, to money. That is true. But public opinion is more impactful than Dan is making here. And when it comes to universal health care, the reason that we are seeing more movement on health care right now is because public opinion is much more in the 60% plus range, whereas political parties have been able to sort of create the specter of single payer as a boogeyman in this country for a long time. So,
Which is funny because they all get that kind of healthcare themselves.
That's a totally different discussion. But I take Dan's point. I do think politicians do have some interest in public opinion. They want votes. They care. They'd like to be
reelected.
Oh,
that's what we're told in lobby meetings constantly is whatever we hear from most this month, that's the issue we're going to address. So last summer when we were trying to talk about climate change, they were getting massive phone calls on healthcare. Maybe it was the summer before that. And so we weren't getting much play with the local staffs because healthcare was the main issue.
The public is on the side of this issue. The Yale climate studies show again and again that nationwide, about 68%, two-thirds of people want action taken on climate change. It's much higher in New York State.
Regardless of political affiliation.
It's there. It's there. It's absolutely there.
Okay. Would you tell Dan that he's being a little too pessimistic about the impact of public opinion?
You know, I feel Dan's pain, without a doubt.
Yeah.
The influence of money on politics is pretty disgusting. That said, we do ultimately vote these people into office. And us average citizens, we have an obligation to both educate ourselves about the issue and get involved in letting our politicians know what we want. Again, like Rob said, if they don't hear from us, then they're not going to, you know, that's their barometer of what to take seriously. So, Dan, I hope that today you will, you know, pick up your phone. And if you haven't called, your congresspeople before, I think like the first time it's sort of intimidating and scary. And then once you've done it like once, it's like, wow, that was so incredibly easy and painless. Only takes a couple of minutes. So just go look up their phone numbers online, call Congressman Morelli, Senator Schumer, Senator Gillibrand, let them know that this is a priority for you.
Excellent advice.
Tim in Pittsford writes to us and says, how are you going to tell the average resident and or homeowner in key parts of just say the northeast part of our own city, which is one of the poorest cities of its size in America, that they are going to buy an electric car or put solar panels on their house? I don't disagree with this bill, but let's be real. The check at the end of the month doesn't cover a car and solar panels. Those are the real average people, not the families that are going to spend the extra money on freaking dance lessons like one of your guests alluded to. And he says, by the way, please explain to me what's going on in France with what looks like a revolt relating to a carbon tax. Yeah. He says, I'm seriously ignorant about what's going on there, but it looks to me like the average person is pushing back.
Do you want to go first, Dan?
So
how do you want to do this?
This bill is not a carbon tax. It's a fee with all of the funds returned. It's a dividend. It's not a tax.
But he's also saying the dividend, which would be, again, average family of four in this country right now, as proposed, roughly $300 a month, a check every month. Tim's still saying that's not enough for most people who are really struggling, who don't even own a car or on the edge here, to go out and put solar panels on their house or buy a car.
Right. So they don't have to. What we're doing in conjunction with this is we're working with communities locally on community choice aggregation to provide electricity to every resident of that community using solar and wind and renewable sources. They can just simply opt in. Basically, they will be opted into that program, and they'll get solar energy just as being part of the resident of the community. They don't have to buy panels. They don't have to spend money for that. It's going to happen. And this bill will drive that kind of change.
Right. Abby.
So I think it's just important to point out that this will not be the only policy that we need to implement to address climate change. This is the first best policy.
Excellent.
And then, you know, as soon as we can just fundamentally change the economics on this, this, you know, how much does it cost to use fossil fuels, then there's incentive to move forward on a lot of other things, including, of course, community choice aggregation. But, you know, we do need to look at our transportation system. We need to, you know, put some investment and money into our local public transit system. Because, in fact, we don't even want everyone to drive an electric car.
No. Right.
We want a better public transportation system so we can all, you know, move away from that. Because that's still a more energy-intensive, you know, mode of transportation, without a doubt.
Okay.
Things will change.
And what about France? He's seeing what's happening in France. Saying,
well, to me, the it's a prime example of if you raise prices on carbon and don't protect residents,
absolutely,
they're going to revolt.
Right.
Therefore, the dividend would probably placate a majority of those people if they receive some money to cover the increased cost.
Which France is not doing.
Right.
Correct.
And another example of that, we use this commonly, is that Australia passed a carbon tax in 2007. And the money was, it was a tax, so the money was returned to government. And within 2 years, it was repealed because the people had no relief from rising prices and they had no trust or no idea. There's no transparency on where that money was going.
So Tim's making a fair point observing France, but you're saying we see that this is different.
This bill is different.
Very different.
Returns money.
Very
that's
different.
A great point. It's
okay.
Great point.
Jillian and Geneseo wants to know, what are the shortcomings of this bill, if any? One of them maybe doesn't go far enough. I don't know. I mean, what are the shortcomings of this bill, if any?
That it hasn't been enacted already.
Okay. Bingo. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of arguments. One that we've heard before, and we know Senator Gillibrand is very interested in agriculture, is how this would affect farmers. And this particular bill has provisions to protect farmers who, you know, have to continue to use fossil fuels until somebody comes up with a combine or a tractor that works on electricity. And so there are protections built in for that. Other than that, I think just not being enacted is the, you know, not being enacted 3 years ago is the biggest drawback.
I got to keep flying through these emails. Philip says, curious, electricity needs to be generated. What are the carbon costs for electric cars?
Well, it's a good point. Cars use energy to be produced. If you live in the Northeast where most of our power is hydro and nuclear, there's not that, you know, it's a real benefit. If you live in an area where coal is producing your electricity, there might not be as much benefit for electric cars in that region. All the more reason to put a higher price on coal and fossil fuels so that electric generation becomes...
That drives commercial scale wind farms and solar farms
and
to provide that.
There also is just some serious planning that's going to need to happen.
Right.
You know, as we electrify all our systems, our home heating, our transportation...
Right. The grid has to change.
The grid's going to have to change.
Okay. David says... pointing out that gas taxes, fuel taxes tend to help with roads and infrastructure costs. What will be the source of revenue to cover that kind of need in the future?
This bill does not address that. I would hope
fair
that the
question.
Gas tax would go up to handle that infrastructure need over time.
But, you know, and we could stop subsidizing fossil fuels. Yeah.
That's a lot of money
That's
left
of
over.
Money.
And if you take money that is reduced for healthcare costs, could spend that on that as well.
I know this. That sounds like a simplification, David, but generally speaking here, the subsidies for fossil fuels are pretty enormous in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't done the math, but if you decide to just put those straight into infrastructure and not subsidize fossil fuels at all, it would be interesting to see how the numbers come out. I don't
That's
have
a lot of jobs, Evan.
Okay. Down to our last minute with our guests. If you want to learn more, it is called the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. There are a lot of different ideas about climate policy, and this is one that you've heard about, and now Congress might actually do this in 2019. There is a bipartisan group of six that has sponsored it, and the question will become, what will the next Congress do? So if you're so moved, our guests want you to get in touch with that and get in touch with them. Some final thoughts here, and I'm going to turn it over to Al, who kind of opened the hour with these optimistic thoughts here. You've heard some pushback. So, or at least some questions. I think these are the right kinds of questions we're hearing about how it rolls out and is implemented. What's next for this? What are you doing next?
This bill is super close to what CCL has been working on for 10 years. And ultimately, it really only does two things. It just does two things. The first is, the biggest concern is to take a serious chunk out of emissions, 90% reduction by 2050. Secondly, we wanted to take care of the poor and middle class to make sure that the increasing expenses we covered for them. That's it. Beyond that, it's a catalyst for incredible changes.
You can learn more now. the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. You can actually read the whole bill if you want online. I've seen it.
Me too.
It's a little wonky, but they've really distilled it in a way that I think they want Congress to grapple with. So we will see what Chris Collins, again, if he calls me back, but Joe Morelli, John Katko, Tom Reed, members of Congress, members of the U.S. Senate. Next year will be a very interesting year in climate policy, and this will be at the top of the menu to see what happens with it. I want to thank our guests for being here. Abby McHugh Griffa, Executive Director of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks as well to Al Hibner, member of Citizens Climate Lobby, that's CCL and Project Drawdown. Thank you, Al.
Thank you very much.
You got it. Rob Levine, member of CCL as well. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you, Evan, for keeping this in the news.
Well, we will have a lot more to talk about in the next year. I promise you that. More connections coming up.